Hey friends, it's Julia here. Before we get into this week's episode with our very special guest talking about all things career and job seeking and equitable hiring, I just wanted to jump in and let you know that we had some technical difficulties on this episode and my internet was quite a mess. So we've done our best editing the episode and I think it's pretty fabulous. But you might notice a couple places where I sound a little choppy, and I hope you listen anyway because our guest is really delivering so much wisdom. And especially if you are a job seeker or a hiring manager or someone who has ever been or ever expects to be a job seeker or hiring manager, I think that's most of us, you're going to get so much from this conversation. So listen, enjoy, and let us know what amazing wisdom you come away with.
Welcome, welcome.
Welcome.
Oh my goodness. We are so excited to be here. It's actually been a minute.
You said you've been running a bed and breakfast, Malia.
Oh my gosh. Yes. I've had so many people in and out of my house. It was actually funny. I would say halfway through like the 2 months that we've had guests visiting, we had some extra pastries that our friends bought, and then they said, oh, don't worry, keep them for your other guests. Mm-hmm. And so when our other guests came, we had all these pastries for them, and we're like, it literally is bed and breakfast.
You have like a whole continental breakfast set up in your home, like,
yeah,
every day.
Exactly. Orange juice, croissant. We had French people come, and they were really telling me how I was saying croissant wrong. So that was my last month, really. 2 months, but like solid label out the last month. But we're back. I'm excited. Everyone's gone. Chibion. Whoever is listening to this and does speak French is going to be like, stop.
Je pas français.
Yeah, your French is pretty good, though. Well, let's get into the podcast. Welcome everyone who's listening. So I just want to paint the picture to set the stage as we're sitting here. We have our tea. If you want, grab a soft blanket, thinking about being in a really cozy place, maybe light a fire or a candle, and you are in your element, energized and nourished by the setting and sense of community. So welcome to the Cozy Impact Pod, a virtual embodiment of this experience where we open the door to topics that impactful people and conscious leaders constantly think about but rarely get to talk about. We are destigmatizing, playing, and laughing our way to greater sense of belonging for our friends in helping professions. From social entrepreneurs like ourselves to activists, nonprofit, and social impact folks, educators, and anyone who wants to contribute to making the world a better place. So welcome home. And we have a beautiful guest here. And Julia, why don't you go ahead and introduce her?
I'm so excited to welcome you, Mariam Mateen, to join us today. You are an Austin-based talent entrepreneur, passionate about making hiring more seamless, equitable, and empowering. Mariam co-founded and co-led Second Day, a nonprofit that helps young diverse talent launch social impact careers through paid internships and career coaching. And most recently, she is building Forward, a job matching platform that connects candidates and companies based on skills and values alignment. In her spare time, she loves cooking while watching bad reality TV. And she's learning
classical Indian dance alongside a group of 8-year-olds. I love that, Mariam. So let's ask the real questions. Why do you want to talk with us today? And what are your greatest strengths and weaknesses?
I feel like my greatest strength, what really brings me here, is I care so much and I work so hard and I have no weaknesses, except for Vanderpump Rules, which I have been binge watching since season one for the last month and a half. So it has been a trip because it starts in like 2012. The fashion is terrible. The way that people talk to women is terrible. There's a lot of it that has not aged well. But I went for it. I watched all 11 seasons in a very shockingly small amount of time. And I have a lot of thoughts and feelings about that too, which I'm happy to share. But no, I'm so happy to be here today. And I really appreciate both of you making space for me to talk about the thing that I obsessively think about, which is making hiring and careers more equitable and accessible to folks. So thank you for having me.
We know, Mariam, that you also used to host a podcast yourself about pop culture and politics. So love that you got that Vanderpump Rules reference in. Thanks for sharing that. Malia, let's pass to you. I think you've got some real questions.
Yeah. So I do. I know, but I just really love these other questions because I think it says a lot about why we, I don't know, like I got into reality TV a couple years ago and it wasn't out of like something that I felt like I needed to do. I was just so curious about human dynamics and so curious about how people were responding and what people were doing and saying. And I think, you know, I think there's a lot to learn from reality TV. And but anyway, I think sharing a little bit about what you do, your journey, and hearing how you got to where you are, I'm just curious what really inspired you or was there a moment when you're like, oh, this is the direction I need to go in?
Yeah, I mean, I think when it started with my first nonprofit, Second Day, so I had had no experience working in talent. I'd had no experience really working directly in social impact. Honestly, I was 24, 25, I think, when this started as a side project. But the thing that pulled me to the work of how do we think about creating pathways into social impact, for me, was actually a lot deeper. I was coming from a place of wanting to unpack how our society considers success and what we consider success to look like. And especially coming from a first generation American family, being the first one in my family to go through the college process in the US, first one to launch a career in the US, I had sort of been presented a very narrow set of options of what are acceptable careers to have after you graduate. And the more that I spent time in the working world, I was like, wait, there's like a lot of other things that are going on in the world that could be really interesting as careers. But I think the way that we've defined what are acceptable jobs is still so small. So for me, that was sort of what initially brought me to this work, is I was excited about working in social impact and bringing more people into social impact, but it definitely came from this place of I want to redefine the way that we have successful careers, and I want to create a space for people to define success for themselves, because for some folks it is going to be the paycheck, and we all need a paycheck. This is the world we live in. But I also wanted to offer other dimensions of what it means to have a cool and exciting career. So that was sort of what brought me to the talent space initially. And it's been, you know, no turning back since then.
Can I ask you this question that Julia asked again of what are the favorite job question, like right when you're in an interview, what are your strengths and what are your weaknesses?
Like for me, like what are my actual strengths and weaknesses?
Well, I want to know, like, what does this question actually pose when it's asked in an interview?
I mean, I think what's so funny about the recruiting process in general, and interviews are such a classic space in which this happens, is there is such a performative element to the hiring process on both sides. job seekers are performing, obviously, in an interview. They want to present a version of themselves that they think the other person wants to hear or see. And companies do this as well, right? You would think that companies are incentivized to be really transparent and honest in the hiring process so they can get the best people. But any recruiter you talk to will tell you it's just a sales pitch. It is just, you are putting on a show, even if you are an employer. So I think that is what's so interesting about questions like that, is that people aren't really going to give honest answers. And so it becomes, how do you tell a story that is compelling versus let's actually dig into what it is that you care about, what it is that you're good at. And I think that's what is really interesting to me about hiring in general.
Oh my gosh, yes. I was just thinking about all of the things I used to say, like all of the ways that I could show off or impress somebody with my strengths. Like, I am a really hard worker. I think you said that, right? I'm a really hard worker. I'm really committed to my job. I'm so detail oriented that sometimes I just am so committed that it's hard for me to not see, to see any other mistakes, right? This like very mechanical.
Yeah.
Those are my weaknesses. My strengths are I get along with everyone. I'm really fun and bubbly while I'm doing all the hard work.
I'm both your personality hire and Julia, your hard worker and your the everything. Yeah.
Julia, what about you?
I'm really disciplined and consistent, which, you know, now having my ADHD diagnosis, and I did, do you know Strengths Finders? Gallup. It's like a, skills, personality traits assessment thing. I did that, and those two were the very bottom of my list, of the whole strengths list. And I was like, okay, I'm going to need to reevaluate this, but that feels true. But I'm also so curious, Mariam, what do you see as the invisible barriers that exist for groups like first-generation college students who you mentioned and, you know, that perpetuate inequities and exclusivity and social impact, but also, you know, in any industry?
Yeah, I mean, it sort of ties to this idea that so much of the job search process is very performative. And I think a lot of the job search process also is measuring for things that aren't obvious. And I found that the process of getting a job is often about how you play the game. Do you know how to network? Do you know how to show up with your email etiquette? Do you know how to tell the story that they want to hear in the interview? And the problem is no one tells you that unless you have like a parent or a mentor who can really lay that out for you and say, by the way, when they ask you about your strengths and weaknesses, this is what they're looking to hear from you. It's not that they want an honest answer. They might want an honest answer, but they also care about how you answer it and not even necessarily the content of your answer. And that isn't intuitive. That isn't obvious. And so unless someone is laying that out for you, you're going to get left behind because you are taking the job description or you're taking the process at face value. And so I think that's one of the things that I find to be deeply frustrating, is that it is so much about how you play the game. And the other thing that bothers me about it is that we know that this doesn't work. Like, the amount of people that get hired for jobs that they weren't actually a good fit for, the amount of mishires that happen, the like rate at which people are leaving their jobs, we know that by taking this from a performative place, that we aren't getting the right people into the right jobs, that we are just rewarding people who know how to play the game. And so I think for me, that's the cycle that I really want to break. And it's not easy. And it's going to require changes on both the job seeker side and the employer side. But I think that to me is where a lot of the inequitable practices in recruiting emerge for me.
I'm just going to repeat what you said right there, of we're perpetuating the cycle of awarding the people who know how to play the game. That is so deep and profound, because it starts making me think about so many different groups of people, marginalized groups. It makes me think a lot, me working in the disability field, is how often people will deselect or not even give somebody the time of day because they're not playing the game. In the same way, whether or not they are aware of it or they're physically capable of it, of being in that place. But if you're not fitting in to this container or idea of success or this job placement, then it's not going to be the right fit. And I think also that shows up a lot is how people will choose the best fit or say, oh, they're the best fit, by not acknowledging certain aspects of people just to be in convenience and, again, urgency culture and that scarcity mindset too.
No, 100%. I think that a lot of it also is employers not understanding that they've set up these systems. I think after a certain point, it becomes so normalized to them that this is how the workplace operates. I think that's something that I'm also really interested in pushing back on through the work that I'm doing now, is thinking about intergenerational diversity in particular, right? I think I heard a really interesting talk recently about how that's sort of the last frontier of diversity work that no one's really touching is intergenerational diversity and age diversity. And the amazing thing is the younger generations entering the workforce, namely Gen Z, are questioning a lot of these norms. The problem is you need to have then leadership and folks in decision-making positions listening to those concerns and listening and being open to the fact that, like, maybe the way that we've been identifying good talent, the way that we've been rewarding what is productivity, the way that we have been growing leadership, maybe that's not actually serving this organization or our people. And so I think there's like a lot of exciting things that are baked into this idea of how do we break the cycle of who is succeeding and who isn't? Because I also think about a story. I have an aunt who's amazing. She's an absolute kick-ass woman. And she has had several positions in senior leadership roles over the years. She was once applying for a job at a, like, for a CEO or a COO level job, and they had her take an evaluation, a personality evaluation, to see if she would be a good CEO. And they said she wouldn't be, based on other people who have taken this test. And she's like, well, everybody who's been at that level at your company has been a white male. I am neither of those things. So it makes sense I wouldn't score on that quiz the same way that they would. And that should be a good thing. You are trying to bring in new leadership, which means you should be looking for folks who are answering those questions differently. But they were looking for the same thing over and over. And I think that's just what is so infuriating about the way we talk about workforce development and the way that we talk about talent and people, is we're using the same frameworks that we've been using for decades when we know that that world has changed so much and the people are way more diverse than they have been in previous workforces. And the way that technology shapes the way we show up in our jobs is really different. So there's just like a lot of layers. I'll pause there, but I think that it goes beyond just the hiring process, right? We have to be thinking about the entire spectrum of the employee experience and how we're growing people in general, you know?
So I am prepping for this keynote right now, and it's about changing the perception of ability. And I was researching what ability means, the definition, and it means where job meets competence. And it gets my brain reeling about competence and who determines competence. So I'm just putting that out there, because exactly what you're sharing is like, who is saying that I am competent from our own perceptions or ideas about another person?
Totally. Yeah. And I was going to say, you know, I think along those lines of assumptions we make about competence and what you talked about, Mariam, about, you know, there is a legacy that definitely continues in many organizations of hiring people who look like you, you meaning white men who are already in positions of leadership, not you personally. And I think it's where I'll admit I have some biases against golf as a sport. One, it's not a great use of land. We could have beautiful public open parks. But two, when I picture this kind of insular and exclusionary set of practices that hand the reins of power down
to, you know, people within organizations or candidates who look the same as those who have been in power for a long time. I picture the golfing boys' day out where boys hire more boys who look like them, who are white and rich. But you also talked about Gen Z. And I know, Mariam, you spend a lot of time talking to folks who are Gen Z and really understand a lot about what it's like to be Gen Z right now. You're not, but your sister is, who you are co-founders with. And, you know, if we could invite a group of Gen Z folks, maybe focused on social impact, maybe not, to join us on our virtual couch, what are some of the things we might hear them griping about when it comes to the job seeker experience?
I think there's a lot of misconceptions about Gen Z, and of course, big asterisks that it is the most diverse generation we've ever had in American history. So everything I say is, I'm going to make some sweeping statements, which is an unfair thing to do in general with any age group. But I can share some of, yeah, what I definitely observed from the folks that I've worked with. And so, yeah, sort of like I touched on, I think there is a lot of misconceptions, right? So my sister, as you mentioned, my co-founder, she's Gen Z. I think a lot of folks have come to me and said, I am frustrated with Gen Z. They are entitled. They are lazy. They don't want to work. There's a lot of that I hear out in the world about Gen Z. My sister is the hardest working person that I know. She wakes up before I do, goes to bed after I do. She works in many ways harder than I do in some things. She's extremely disciplined. Like, she's amazing. And I think that what people get wrong about Gen Z is that they are willing to work. They want to show up. They want to do well. But they want to also have autonomy. And they want to have say over their own life and how they show up and how they get it done. And I think that that's so deeply uncomfortable for folks who have been in the workforce for a while, because I think a lot of us have this immediate gut reaction of like, well, I had to figure it out. I had to make sacrifices. I had to get to my desk before my boss showed up and leave after he did. Like, I was told to do all of those things. And millennials, let's not forget, had all these same reputations. When we were entering the workforce, we were obsessed with avocado toast and we're never going to own a house. So we all had our kind of generational things and baggage. And I feel like in many ways, we actually did adapt pretty seamlessly to older cultures of the workforce. But I think Gen Z is not folding as easily. And I think that's what's creating a lot of this tension. So I think what you would hear from a group of Gen Zers who are coming in is, one, they would say that they are willing to work, but they have questions and they want to understand why and not just what. They want to understand, why are we doing what we are doing? Why are we set up the way that we are set up? And why do we practice this business the way that we practice it? I think something that's been really interesting to hear from recruiters is that they're getting asked tougher questions than they ever have before. And filling entry-level jobs is harder than it's ever been before because people are holding themselves and companies to a higher standard. And I think that's a really good thing. And I feel that it's just going to require some tough conversations. And for so long, employers came from a position of power that they were like, this is who we are, either, you know, step in line or step out. And I just don't think that's the dynamic as much in these conversations anymore. So I think that's really exciting. And I think the other thing that Gen Z wants to understand and wants to talk about is showing up authentically at work, right? I think we have said this for a long time. People are like, be yourself at the workplace, you know, blah, blah, blah. And I think that they are actually doing that for real in a way that I feel, again, as a millennial, I think I was pretty performative at work. I was still myself, but I was like a work-friendly version of myself, which is fine. I feel like that's okay. But I think that Gen Z is just like fully showing up as themselves. And I think that's really interesting. So I think that's something they would also want to talk about is like, I'm going to show up as myself actually. Is that fine? Like, I'm going to do that. Like, what does that mean for how I interact with my team and things like that? So those are some of the things that I have definitely noticed. I'm happy to go into more detail, but those are a couple of themes for sure.
It's like we're creating so much more space for everyone to bring their, you know, we're talking about strengths, right? Or bring like what naturally flows for them, or what their talents are, what lights them up, what excites them. We're naturally creating more space for everyone to be able to do those things. And I always think about this, like when I talk about my quote unquote weaknesses, they're actually more of my strengths to know them, like very detail oriented things like editing a document. I will miss the typos. I will miss your typos. I promise you, they will not be edited. And then if I'm trying to fit myself in a box of I have to be this way, or I have to make sure that I am the fine-tooth comb editor, when there's someone else who just, it comes so naturally to them to be that fine-tooth comb editor, how do we start to work together so that we can pass things off on one another? And there was also something that you shared that made me think about my mom. So my mom works in a corporate organization, and she was saying that there are entry level. So they actually have their minimum entry level salary is $80,000 for this company, which I think is pretty good. And my mom said that there were Gen Z coming out of college saying, well, so-and-so is making $85,000 or $90,000, so I want $85,000 or $90,000. And she says, but you just started and you have no experience. And I was talking to her about this and I said, you know, that's valid. Both are valid, right? Like, yes, I think when we get experience, when we learn more, when we have more information, we have more of a skill set, then, you know, we can get more money. And also at the same time, I said, these Gen Z adults are growing up in a world where they know that everything is so much more expensive than it's ever been. Inflation just skyrocketed. It's hard to have a living wage under $80,000. And to I have this idea of this being the norm, or you got to work your way up. I actually think, I don't know what the actual scientific, like economical studies of what actually a living wage in Southern California is. But to me, I'm like, ooh, 80,000. I feel like I could have an apartment and buy groceries. I could meet my needs probably. But I think what Jen,
I wanted to pause in case Julia, there you go. Yeah.
I might not have
I'm leaving long pauses just in case for your delay, Julia.
I might not have these same truths that our parents have had or the boomer generation has had. And so I have to think about these things initially so that I can support myself and move forward. And it was hard to have that connection there. And I was like, oh, both of these things are true.
Yeah. We also know that because of inflation, our minimum wage really should be much, much higher. And obviously it's state by state, but there is a point to be made that I think Gen Z is advocating for in a way that, quite frankly, I don't think we as millennials had the power or leverage to advocate for as such, just a large generation. Where we were all kind of fighting each other to get unpaid internships starting out, which was should have been illegal from the get-go and was obscene. But I think Gen Z also understands that we haven't kept pace with the cost of living over time. And so I think there's a whole, I so value Gen Z's advocacy. Knowing that if they're successful at things like salary negotiation, labor organizing, I mean, that is at the root of a lot of the shifts I think that Gen Z advocates for, then it will be better for all of us. I think that's the reality.
Well, there was something, Miriam, that you said about how it's not about the what, but it's the why. And that question always, ooh, gets me going. Because I'm thinking right now, there's this Gen Z generation entering the workforce. There's advocacy for themselves. There is accountability. There's asking deeper questions. And there's also, how did we get ourselves set up in this situation where there has been so many limitations or has been the join the club situation? And how are we working in a multi-generational environment? And I wonder if you have any thoughts about how we are all shifting collectively together.
It's a really good question. I don't know that I have a perfect answer. I think the way that we can shift more productively and meaningfully is by having exactly the kind of conversations that you and your mom had, right? Where you can unpack that there are multiple truths at play in our lived experience. Because I think what Gen Z actually very often gets wrong in a lot of the conversations I've had with them is they don't consider who's on the other side of the equation often. And what I mean by that is when they're saying, oh, I should be getting paid 90, they may not understand. And this is a lot of this is just a knowledge gap, but they may not understand that it is not in the power of the hiring manager to change their salary. There is a preset salary range for different levels that has been created that they can't do anything about. And so having empathy that everybody is trying to do their best, and what lived experience is this other person coming from? So another example that had come up is work events, right? So having to do a company happy hour on a Tuesday at 6:30, for a long time, that was super normal, right? Like, we all did that. You went to the thing, you schmoozed, whatever, and you gave up your Tuesday. You weren't going to make your workout class. Like, you weren't going to get to go home at a normal time. You were, you know, going to be out with your team on a Tuesday. And I was talking to someone who had voiced that her younger Gen Z workers were really unhappy with having to do work events on a Tuesday. And this woman was like, I'm really trying to be accommodating and trying to respect people's boundaries, but this is a big part of how our industry operates, and I don't know what to do. And again, you just have to sit down and have the conversation of like, hey, I totally hear, like, let's talk about why you don't want to show up on a Tuesday after work. Like, I want to genuinely understand what is creating that feeling for you. And then let me explain my experience of when I've done these happy hours. Here's the experience that I've had, and here's how I've managed my schedule. And at the end of the day, do what's right for you. But let's talk about it and not just take for granted, like, what should be happening, if that makes sense. And so I think that's something that we really need to do if we're going to collectively move forward, is understand the other person's lived experience. And again, I think there's been such a long culture of being performative at work that doesn't necessarily create vulnerable spaces for people to have those conversations. And I think that's the other piece as it ties to recruiting. I think something that y'all had asked earlier is, how does recruiting feel for people who come from non-dominant identities? Like, how are their barriers? And I think if you've had certain types of people who are hiring and then bringing in more people like them, and you've created really homogenous spaces, if you are interacting with a first-gen college student and you don't have that lived experience, then you're not going to understand maybe why they are showing up to an interview the way that they are showing up. You're not going to understand why they have certain priorities at work that are not the same as yours. But it's because there hasn't been any space in the hiring process in the workplace to have those vulnerable and open conversations in a safe way in both directions. And so I just think that, like, vulnerability at work is going to be really core to all of us collectively getting better and learning from one another.
What is your vision for what a truly equitable job seeker experience could look and feel like?
I think fundamentally what it would be is looking at a whole person, looking at them holistically and humanizing. I think what so many people feel, especially in the environment right now, is they feel really dehumanized by the recruiting process and by the hiring process. And I don't think there's malicious intent. I think the full infrastructure of hiring is completely broken. And nearly every recruiter I talk to feels the same way. So this is not me bashing recruiters. I think the systems that we have built are just collapsing, right? And I think part of that is because we do have such a diverse set of folks who are entering the workforce, and not just like racial, ethnic diversity, identity diversity, like diversity of work experience, of educational backgrounds, of the industries that they have been involved in and the issues that they care about, the skills that they've developed. All of that is incredibly diverse. And I think the way that we are currently asking people to show up in the hiring process does not capture that at all. I think resumes as they exist are really meant to put you in a box versus give you the space to talk about what you are really good at, what you care about, and what impact you've had. I think that same, and we've been talking about interviewing, right? There's a really performative element to interviewing that is counterproductive for everybody. And so I think that's a big thing that I care about, is we have to have a fair way to evaluate candidates. Of course, I think you have to have some standard practices, but I think that my vision is creating a standard practice that serves more people than it currently serves right now. So rethinking, like I said, the way we look at resumes, rethinking the way that we expect people to do cover letters. I also think it's on employers. I think employers should be thinking about how they write job descriptions, right? A really common thing I hear, particularly from the folks that I worked with at Second Day, who were mostly first-gen college students, low-income college students, like 85% people of color, when they would look at job descriptions, very often they would count themselves out. They would see the 20 bullet points of things that you have to have and be like, oh, there's no way I'm qualified to do this. Very, very common situation. And if we want to bring in more diverse talent pipelines, if we want to create a more equitable hiring process, part of it is the information that you are putting out and the candidates that you're even attracting in the first place. So I think there's a lot of pieces, and I could literally spend a whole 30 minutes going piece by piece of what I would want to change. But I think those are the fundamental questions to me, right? Is like, how are we holistically capturing candidates that is still fair? How do we not rely too much on those unspoken norms and create more honest and authentic conversations and interactions between candidates and companies? And then also ask companies to be way more transparent and thoughtful about the information they are putting out so that folks can be thoughtful about where they want to put their own energy as candidates too.
Can we talk about the whole must have 5 years experience as blah, 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 blah? And how that's not always true.
It's crazy. I recorded a TikTok about this recently. Go check it out. But one of the really striking things that I learned in starting to work with employers over the last few years is, again, everyone's doing their best, but a lot of smaller companies in particular don't have an HR person on staff who knows how to write great job descriptions or thoughtful job descriptions. The number of employers that I've worked with were like, oh, we've just been using the same boilerplate job description for years. They're not really making edits, including years of experience. There are those classic stories of job descriptions that end up out in the world that are asking for like 10 years of experience with AI when AI hasn't existed in the public domain for more than like 2 years, right? There are a lot of those examples. So I always tell people, do not pay too much attention to years of experience. What years of experience is really trying to get at is, in my opinion, a few things. I think it, one, wants to see how long you've been in the workforce in general. There are a lot of companies who unfortunately don't want to be someone's first employer, which we can talk about, but they would rather have someone who has been in an office before or who knows how to, you know, maneuver a company setting, and they don't have to train them up from literally ground zero. So there's that. And then I think they're also just trying to get at, how much training are you going to need? Have you done anything like this before? And so don't, yeah, hold yourself too much to years of experience. Really focus on what projects you would be working on in that role, what kind of skills you would need to have from day one, which again, I can kind of go into much more detail. But I think, again, job descriptions are so haphazard in how they are often written, which is so frustrating. Because again, as I said at the beginning, job seekers, that's the source of information they have, right? Is what the job description says. So when you hear employers saying like, oh yeah, that's like an old job description. We've been recycling it for ages. We haven't really updated it in a while. It's not a big deal. It's like, no, that is a really big deal because someone's going to read that and why wouldn't they trust what it says? So yeah, I have a lot of gripes with job descriptions, including years of experience for sure.
Mariam, what should employers be doing differently? Like if you had ultimate power, or let's just say a magic wand, and you could make some changes on the spot in the easiest way possible, what would you have employers do differently in their hiring process?
Oh, gosh, there's a lot of things. I think the first thing that I always recommend people do is to pause and think about, like, what are their must-haves and what are their nice-to-haves? And rather than throwing everything on a page of things that they are looking for, and this is part of what we're trying to do with Forward, is force them to prioritize, okay, especially if this is like a job that is 0 to 2 years work experience, kind of a role, or an early career or an entry-level job, chances are you don't expect them to show up with every skill already ready to go. And if you do, then you probably need to rethink the role itself. But assuming, yeah, you're wanting to bring in someone early career, rather than those 20 bullet points, focus on 3 or 4 things that are really important to the role. And then tell them maybe, for example, what are they going to get trained in? Tell them about what they could expect in terms of growth opportunities and mentorship and professional development. That's something people care a lot about. Tell them about some of the practical elements around, would they be in person? How often do they have to do after work events? There's a lot of stuff that is not portrayed in a job description that are actually really strong decision makers or deal breakers for people. So I think just rethinking what is the most important information that we're sharing at the upfront so that you're not wasting your time with candidates who are not actually going to be interested in that role or good for that role. And then I think the second thing is being way more transparent into what it's going to be like in that job and what kind of person's going to thrive. And so I'll give an example of the job that I had before I started second day was Chase. It's huge bank, very corporate environment in a lot of ways. And I had an amazing manager when I was there. And I remember when he interviewed me, he said, you know, I can tell you're somebody who likes to move quickly and likes to get things done and see projects come to life. And I'm going to tell you right now, this is not that kind of environment. And I'm worried that you'll get really frustrated with how slow things move in a corporate environment. And I think about that a lot. I'm like, how many employers in an interview would say, hey, you seem amazing, but like this kind of environment might be frustrating for XYZ reason. Like, just wanted to flag that. How many people's lives would be different if they had had that conversation before they took a job, right? So I think also removing those performative pieces and being more transparent would make everyone's lives better. So those are a few things that come to mind. And I think really, again, if you're going to be committed to DEI, which, again, we can talk about that for ages of what is commitment to DEI look like and when is it real? I think that the hiring in the recruiting space is one of the most under-resourced areas when it comes to DEI. I think there's so much emphasis, rightly, on like how to improve certain practices once you're in the job. But again, I think that like unless we fundamentally think about how we are evaluating candidates and how we are bringing candidates in, then in my opinion, what's the damn point?
Completely. So how does your company Forward come into this? And what are your initiatives or really here to put out into the world to help everyone in this hiring process?
Yeah, I'm super pumped about it. So I, like I said, spent several years working directly with job seekers through Second Day. So did a ton of programming, worked with hundreds of folks one-on-one, understanding sort of what the pain points were for them when they were navigating the job market, especially in social impact, but definitely not exclusively, right? I think several things really came up that we've sort of already talked about today around feeling dehumanized by the recruiting process, feeling unclear about how to position their past experiences or both their professional and lived experiences, I would say, in particular, people not really feeling confident about what they could bring to the table. That was a really, really common thing that I saw, is that folks had assumptions about, oh, I'm not the kind of candidate they could ever want. And that was really devastating to see, like I said, people counting themselves out of the running so early. And so I wanted to think about more broadly, where is recruiting broken and where can we meaningfully change that infrastructure that I talked about at the beginning that I feel like is really broken. And so Forward is going to be a tech tool, a tech platform for both job seekers and employers. And the way that it's going to work is that instead of a traditional kind of resume cover letter format, we have these profiles that you'll create on Forward, which focus more on your skills and your priorities and interests instead of your credentials, meaning like the job titles you've had, the education level you're at, things like that. That's actually deprioritize. And we're focusing on the meat of what people actually care about is, can you do the job? Like, do you want to be here? Those are the two things that employers fundamentally want to know, but it's all getting buried in this noise of resume, cover letters, blah, blah, blah. So Forward is trying to bring that information to the forefront and create some of that standard language so it is still as fair as possible for everybody. But we're also going to embed a lot of educational materials into the platform. So for people who haven't spent a lot of time in the job market, we're going to be also with them every step of the way. And it's going to be sort of like a dating app, actually. So you'll get fed a certain number of jobs every week, and you'll have a limited number of likes that you can put out to jobs. So you're really prioritizing, like I said, what jobs are actually of interest to you and are most important to you. And then employers will see all those profiles, an anonymous version of those profiles in their dashboard. And then if they are interested in your profile, they'll also swipe right on you, so to speak. And then you'll actually get to interact directly with the employer that way. And so the idea is, again, you're leading with your skills and your values up front, and you're not sinking time into applications without knowing that someone has even looked at your materials, because I think that's a very common pain point. And then, yeah, we're there sort of coaching you every step of the way as an early career professional. And yeah, so there's a bunch more to it, but that's kind of the fundamentals that we're really excited about. And we've gotten really positive feedback. So we're going to be piloting this summer, likely just in Austin to start, but would love to have people in the wait list and love people to check it out as soon as it goes live in the next few months.
I love that. And I'm so excited for you. And I love hearing about this personalized process. And while you were saying that you have 5 jobs that you can like, and I was like, whoa, the amount of times I have been looking for jobs in my past, but looking for jobs and saying, okay, just like throw it at the wall, try to make my talents look good. And I think there's so much of what you're saying about experience, understanding yourself, understanding what really feels so aligned that you can show up. But I think this makes me think a lot about like skill sets or talents that are actually coming not from your job experience, but from your lived experience, what you've learned, what you've seen, where your brain naturally goes, where your creativity goes. And it makes me think, and I think we all probably have had an experience like this. And I'm thinking about my husband right now and how he's noticing his talents, but still really struggles to communicate those things that he's really good at. And so he keeps trying to do the things that he's not very good at. And that conversation that you can have with your employer or someone that you're looking to be your employer, like, what does that start to do when we actually take those barriers down? And also, especially for non-dominant groups, like, what skill set starts to emerge from the things that are known beyond just the play the game, be in the club aspects?
I mean, I think that something I've really noticed for my folks who have both an incredible blend of lived experience and work experience and how they have sort of built a skill set is there's so much about navigating the working world that doesn't actually have to do with your hard skills. It has to do with your emotional intelligence. It has to do with the way that you develop relationships with people, if you're resourceful, if you have grit, if you're organized. I mean, those sorts of things really are what set you apart in the working world. And again, I think that that's not something that's really totally understood until you start working. Like, we've probably all worked with people who had amazing technical skills and like zero people skills. And they just didn't go as far because at some point you do need some of these skills that are not easily quantified, but are super important. And I think that's the other really ironic thing to me about how we do things like resumes is that resumes are meant to focus on your technical skills. Like, what have you actually done? It's not a space where you can actually capture things like, have you had to manage a schedule in which you've worked three jobs during your semester? Have you worked in retail and had to deal with really challenging customers and keep your cool? Like, those sorts of things people don't include in the resumes because they think that is not relevant, or it gets really lost in a resume, or it doesn't get focused on because they think that that's less professional to talk about that sort of stuff. So I think that those are the things that I have really noticed, is that those are qualities actually a lot of entry-level jobs are calling for, but that isn't being captured in traditional recruiting. And so I think that's one of those really interesting gaps that I actually encourage folks like to tell those stories. And you don't owe your trauma to anybody. You don't have to like share everything that, you know, has shaped your lived experience. But I think that leaning into those moments in which you've really had to push yourself, or you've really had to teach yourself something, or manage a lot of work at once, or again, be resourceful, be scrappy, like that is actually incredibly valuable. And even though the recruiting process doesn't naturally bring that stuff up, there are other ways that you can incorporate those experiences, which I'm happy to speak to. But I would say don't shy away from those things. Those things are truly superpowers that you can bring into the workforce.
Yeah, definitely. And I also want to acknowledge for those who are out there listening who do just have technical skills, which I don't know if we attract this crowd as much. But if you are out there with the sole technical skill, I think there is a space and a place where you can thrive in certain environments where it's solely focused on technicality. And I'm naming that too, because what you're saying is so true, and having those soft skills and seeing people with more of these emotional and soft skills really see their growth in their careers. But also that might not be accessible to another person in certain ways. And so I just want to name that because every person is so different and everything that clicks for people is so different.
Yeah. And I just want to name, this is actually another area that I think employers really have to think like creatively and critically. So one example is like how we promote people, right? So this is, again, I'm thinking a lot about my time at Chase. I worked with a lot of technical folks who were really brilliant, but they were not good people managers. And they knew it. They knew they weren't good people managers, but Chase had such a narrow way in which you were rewarded. And that was that you moved up the ranks, you got paid more, but you also were then put in charge of people. But a lot of them did not want to be in charge of people. So how do you create pathways for folks to grow and get the recognition they deserve, but still be set up to do good work in a way that works for them, right? And I think that's exactly what you're talking about, is that there are folks who do better doing solo work, but we still haven't figured out a good way to give them leadership in a way that makes sense for who they are as people. So I think that's like another really interesting space for companies to think creatively about keeping good people in a way that they'll still be maximizing their impact and be happy day to day.
Mariam, what I'm hearing is that you as an entrepreneur have some other potential explorations in the field of.
Yeah, I mean, I think that this is kind of, there's a lot to unpack here, right? Obviously, I'm really passionate about recruiting and I'm passionate about hiring, because I think that is the first touch point that anybody has with a company, right? Is what it is like to be an applicant. And so something that I'm really proud of with Second Day, so we just hired two new people for the first time in the last 6 to 8 months. And shout out to our new executive director, Jorge Mendez. He did an incredible job hiring our second ever full-time hire, Aaron. And everybody who went through the recruiting process was given timely communications most of them were given feedback where we were able to do it. We stuck to the timeline that we said. We were transparent every step of the way. We compensated for the heavier projects at the end of the application process. And the amount of positive feedback that we got from folks, even if they got rejected, because obviously everybody but one person got rejected for the job, people were genuinely grateful because they felt like their time was well used, that they were seen, and that it was a fair experience. So just because you reject someone doesn't mean, you know, that they have to be bitter at your company, right? Because hopefully we could hire somebody from that pool in the future for some reason, and we've built good brand equity from now. And the larger point I make there is that the way that we designed our hiring process was really in line with our company values and what we believe that Second Day should do in the world and how we should show up in the world. And so I think the reason that this is where I get so excited is because I actually think that a lot of people don't see it that way. They think about their company culture as starting from day one of you as a new employee. I would argue your company culture starts from when you're interacting with potential employees. And so that's why I get really excited about that space. But this is like a whole journey that someone's going to have, right? From the first application that they submit to their exit interview. And I do think there's like a lot of cool things that are happening in that journey that would be cool to work on at some point in the future. But I just feel that especially recruiting, and especially recruiting for early career talent, there's so much talk and resources around hiring senior folks, C-suite executives, like presidents, board members, as there should be. Those are the decision makers and they do play a huge role. But I'm also somebody who really wants to be an advocate for those who are the least seen. And right now it is early career talent. It is Gen Z. Like, I think there's a lot of people talking about Gen Z and very few people talking to Gen Z. And so if I can be that bridge, if I can be somebody who can represent them and like create more space at the table for them to be part of that conversation, that's really, really important to me. So I think this is where I'm going to stay for a while. But maybe as more Gen Z folks enter positions of leadership, I'll like keep following them around. But I don't know. I think that this is a space that is so rich for improvement, honestly, and for meaningful changes that can then reverberate across much larger areas of work.
Ultimately, you are helping people feel so seen and just finding so much more flow and efficiency in all of the ways that we can show up. And I just see how passionate you are about this. And it's so exciting to see, like, there's a beacon of light going in that direction. And I loved that you talked about this interview process for your company, because I'm just thinking about the people who felt like they were seen for the first time. So when they have that experience, that creates even more space for other organizations, other companies, other experiences. And it reminds me of a time I interviewed for, I mean, it was a restaurant job, but I interviewed for a job and sat at the table with this guy who was hiring, and he didn't make eye contact with me once. And I walked out and said, I don't want this job. Like, there's no way I want this job. And I actually don't ever want to eat here again. And what starts to happen from that place? And I love what you're sharing. I feel like there's so much information that you just shared that whoever is listening, I hope, takes away from this and feels inspired to work with you and also create more impact in their organizations or what they're doing, or even if they're social entrepreneurs and doing their own work, how they interact with the people that they are collaborating with and creating relationships with. So, Miriam, how can people reach you, get to know you? We'll share it in the show notes, but what is like percolating right now that people can connect with you?
I feel like there's so much percolating that the coffee pot runneth over right now, but that's okay. That's good. It's a good problem. There's a lot of places that you can connect with me. I am both fortunately and unfortunately very active on LinkedIn. So that is my social media platform of choice right now. I share a lot of updates on Forward and resources related to the job search process. So that's a great place to follow me. I am also dabbling in TikTok for as long as we have it, theoretically. So I've been sharing videos on a lot of the stuff that we talked about today, how to set yourself up for success in the job search process. So be sure to check that out. And otherwise, go to forwardjobs.io to join our waitlist. And yeah, again, very grateful to be here and to be a resource to your listeners and to share space with both of you. This has been so delightful.
Oh my gosh, Miriam, this has been so amazing. I'm like beaming right now, just so excited. And all my disability field things are really, really also percolating. So much coffee. And I'm just so grateful. We are both so grateful that you are here and so excited for what you're creating and what you're putting out into the world. And thank you to everyone who had listened. And we're so grateful for all of you. And we will see you all very soon. Bye.